She's a replicant, isn't she?
I'm impressed. How many questions does it usually take to spot one?
I don't get it, Tyrell.
How many questions?
20, 30 cross-referenced.
It took more than 100 for Rachel, didn't it?
She doesn't know.
She's beginning to suspect, I think.
Suspect? How can it not know what it is?
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto. Rachel is an experiment, nothing more.
Welcome to Double Impact, the podcast where we double back on the movies that impacted us growing up as 90s kids and decide whether they hold up today or best left in the past. I'm Tristan.
And I'm Greg. What are we now, like week three? How many aliens?
Week three of...
Androids. How many androids have we discussed?
Well, androids is, I don't know if that's a cool term, man.
Oh.
It's 2023.
Is that not PC?
I don't know, maybe.
What is the preferred term?
Well, Ridley Scott didn't like it. That's all I know.
Sorry, Ridley.
Yeah, third film in our artificial intelligence miniseries. We're back in the 80s. We're back in a very, very synthy, neon-y kind of, well, futuristic 80s era. So we thought maybe it's time for a guest, maybe a very special guest, maybe a synth lord in and of himself. A very special guest, Mr. Sunglasses Kid, aka Edward Gamper. Welcome to the pod.
Hello.
Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
We recently connected on Instagram.
We did.
And I think I even said to you, I was going to say, I don't mean this as emotional as it sounds, but maybe I do. I was like, I can't believe it took me this long to find you.
Well,
your music speaks directly to my soul.
I feel like a lot of people have recently discovered me in the last couple of months because I had a couple of videos go viral on social media and so I suddenly went from having 10,000 to 130,000 followers over the last 2 months and have just been discovered kind of whole new kind of audience of people. So I'm getting a lot of people asking, why didn't you put out an album? It's like, I have three, but...
You have three. Yeah. I was listening to Nightlife all day today.
Cool.
And then I haven't listened to the other ones yet, but it's a vibe, man. It is like I have... Without going into too much detail, I have some trouble sometimes focusing on work and I'm always looking for those YouTube lo-fi remixes and I think I found my latest concentration jams.
Good.
It's good ambience, gets you in the zone, makes you feel like you're in a movie.
Like prepping you for a shootout in a warehouse.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's not quite as chill. Although I was going to say on the whole, if you like lo-fi and like study music, the lo-fi girl that's like been around for years has suddenly released a kind of sister or brother channel called Synthwave Boy, and is making kind of synthy, chill concentration music. So
I like it.
Well, no, don't take the attention away from yourself. This is a shout out for you.
It's all about
me. So, yeah, friends of the show, make sure you're following Sunglasses Kid on Instagram. Check him out on Spotify, Apple Music. Anywhere you find good synthy stuff, he's right there.
This is the beauty of the back catalogue as well. So now that stuff can just go to work.
Yeah.
Indeed, yeah.
We're hoping that'll happen to us one day.
One day.
What you'll accidentally make music or you'll go viral?
just somehow have... our back catalogue pay off in some fashion. Maybe one day.
Tell us a bit about yourself. What's your background, mate? How did you get into music and et cetera?
Yeah.
I started making music when I've been around it for years, and I started making kind of tunes on a old, in fact, it's the keyboard that I have to the left of me, which was my mum's keyboard. She was a composer. She bought like one of the early kind of synthesizers by Korg. And I was kind of around it from those early years. And I think I also had this big love of movies as well. And kind of two spoke to me a bit when I started hearing synthesized music. And then I went to film school. And whilst I was at film school, I got to know a guy who composed his own scores to shorts. And he really inspired me and hooked me up with some software that he found on a CD. And I started making music sort of in my early teens. And then had a big hiatus from music off. So I had ambitions to be like a film composer, struggled, gave up in my early 20s, thinking I was kind of done with it. And then for some reason, I was out of work between two jobs I was doing and started making 80s music. I don't know why it was 80s. I just found I had a knack for it. And I think synthesizers, you always accidentally start sounding 80s unless you're very careful anyway, since.
Yeah, and, that's true.
I just found a knack for it and it just spoke to me and kind of... So I think like what I do is a bit of a synthesis between kind of the film and the music world, and I love to kind of bring people along on a kind of filmic journey, so to speak.
Hell yeah.
Love it.
We're going to transcend that bridge right now.
Let's do it.
I mean, in the perfect movie, right? Did you say this is your favorite film?
Blade Runner is my favorite movie. For a long time, I was like, I didn't like to commit to saying I had a favorite movie. I think a lot of people don't want to say that. Like, I think not everyone says, oh, I don't have one favorite movie, because it is really hard. But the more as I get older, I'm like, I don't get the impression any better, more good films are coming. I feel like the best films are behind us. And like, and every time I see Blade Runner, it just is such a rich, like, film, like aesthetically, music, the performance. Harrison Ford's one of my favorite actors. Everything yeah. about Blade Runner is just, it's just a near perfect film. Apart from, I suppose there's a few things about the different cuts. I have like gripes about little things with each cut, but it's just an amazing movie. So ahead of its time, and it just still holds up and looks fantastic. Everything about it looks brilliant. Yeah.
I mean, total agreement. But before we dive in any deeper, Greg has some rapid fire questions for you.
Okay.
You know, they help the friends of the show get to know you a little better, get a little like center of gravity. What's this guy about?
Yeah, what makes him tick?
Yeah.
Okay. How rapid firing are these?
Well, look, they're sort of like an A or B type thing.
Okay, let's do it.
All right. We'll kick off at the top. This might be, well, I was going to say this would be an easy one, but Harrison Ford's the answer for both. Indiana Jones or Han Solo?
Oh man, that's hard. I think I'll go with Indiana Jones. Just because Han Solo is a bit more of a kind of secondary character, I feel, in Star Wars, and I love temples and treasure. I don't think there's enough cool treasure hunting
and
movies.
Doom. No, that's true. There's not.
There's not. Like you feel like there's loads, but there isn't. And in fact, the kind of real nerd fact, not about Indiana Jones, but when I first saw the first Tomb Raider, the Angelina Jolie one, I was so like taken with the set of all the temples and everything. I kind of was Googling, where is this? This is the best looking set I've ever seen in a movie. And I was like, oh my God, these are real temples. And I actually ended up going with a mate to Asia and visited Cambodia, which is where all those temples are. And it's as close as you can get to being Indiana Jones, because there's some that are full of tourists taking photographs of trees. And then there are ones where there's just no one, because it's 10 square kilometers of temples hidden in jungle. So if you want to play Indiana Jones, Cambodia is the place to do it.
Yeah.
And it's super cool. You can be on your own, kind of jumping around in the jungle. But yeah, like, so I'm going to say Indiana Jones, and Last Crusade is my favorite of the three.
There you go. Nice. Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan?
I'm going to say Jackie Chan. Do you know what? I've seen a criminally low amount of Bruce Lee films. I think I've only seen Enter the Dragon, but Chan I've always loved. I loved it. I love his sort of mix of comedy and Rumble in the Bronx is brilliant.
Ooh, sure
I'm
is.
Trying to think of other Jackie Chan films now as well. But I love his stunts. I think Bruce Lee sort of doesn't quite speak to me. He seems to take himself a bit too seriously, whereas I love Chan. But yeah, Chan.
It's the Chan man.
He's a Chan man. He's the big one. Pamela Anderson or Sally Field?
I'm not even, do you know what? I'm not even sure who Sally Field is. So I'm going to say Pamela Anderson. Who's Sally Field? Who is she? What's she in? God.
She's in the later stages of her career. She's the mum from Mrs. Doubtfire. You might know
she's
her
the
as.
Mum from Forrest Gump. She's the mum from
okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was still going to say
Pamela Anderson. We haven't, I think we had our first, we've only had one from about a dozen or so, say Sally Field. So that's,
Yeah.
Understandable. I have a penchant for Sally. That's the nature of this question. Nothing more to it.
Greg's seeking out allies. That's really what this is about.
Trying to find finding Fieldman is the exercise. So
I've evidently put myself in terribly bad books with Greg, seeing as I didn't even know who Sally Field was.
I'm a penny man too, at the end of the day.
At the end of the day, but at the beginning of the day.
Oh, yeah, she's a morning girl. Okay, let's get into some synth territory. Beverly Hills Cop or Escape from New York?
Oh, man, ooh, that's tough, dude. That's really tough. The first Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to probably say Escape from New York then, because I think Escape from New York is just a more atmospheric film. I love Beverly. If it had been Beverly Hills Cop 2 versus Escape from New York, I'd be Beverly Hills Cop 2 all day long.
There you go.
I prefer Beverly Hills Cop 2 just because of the whole Billy Rosewood and shotguns and rocket launchers and chewing gum and flick knives and the alphabet crimes. And
is that Tony Scott?
Yeah, it's Tony Scott. Is it? Yeah, it is.
It is. Oh, yeah. There you go. The Scott's back at it.
Yeah.
What a family. Okay. Scarface or Drive? Now, I'm referring to the scores here.
Ooh.
The scores? That's a tricky one because I have a lot to thank for the Drive score, because the Drive score really did sort of inspire the genre that I'm associated with, which is synthwave. And I've actually played on stage twice. I've played at gigs shows with College, who wrote A Real Hero. So I've met him twice. And had dinner with College on a boat.
That's cool.
And so I have a lot of historical connection to the Drive soundtrack and the movie. But I will say, what was the other one you just said? What was the other movie?
Scarface.
It's got to be Scarface.
Yeah.
Are we talking the Marauder score or the incident or the various artist music or just the whole everything? I'm going to say Scarface.
All of the above.
Yeah. I'm going to say Scarface. Although I saw Giorgio Moroder perform live in London not long ago. And I was strapping in for thinking he was going to be playing Scarface in Neverending Story. But it was all his disco hits, and he wasn't really playing at all. He had two women and a man that looked like they were on a cruise liner singing the songs. He had like what looked like about 100 grams worth of synths that he never played. He just walked around on stage with a tambourine, looking like someone's grandpa had stumbled onto a cruise, and it was it was very weird. But Moroder Scarface, let's go.
Alrighty, some big names coming at you. Zimmer or Morricone?
Oh my God, that is hard. Because reluctantly, I'm going to say Zimmer, but I love Morricone. They're almost on a level pegging, but they're so different.
Yeah.
But there's like Morricone soundtracks for like Untouchables. The Mission is amazing. But I like 90s Zimmer more than I like Zimmer now. If it's between like a lot of people, when you say Zimmer now, people think the Interstellar soundtrack and the Inception soundtrack.
Wow.
And I just think of like Broken Arrow being one of the most awesome scores, and Days of Thunder. So the 90s Zimmer.
90s Zimmer.
Yeah.
That's a nice build. I think I need to do a bit of discovery there, because I've probably unfortunately fall into that category you mentioned of thinking of probably the movies you mentioned. So I might need to go back and have a bit of listen to Broken Arrow.
Well, Broken Arrow is nuts. I nerdily bought like the double CD anniversary collection of it. It's super rare for like 50 quid or something. But if I recall, I think the movie that sort of marked Zimmer's sudden pivoting into this slightly more ethereal, repetitive sort of score that you hear in things like Inception and Interstellar was The Thin Red Line. And he went into this very minimal kind of sound. And then that's when he sort of got this new sort of shtick that he does in a lot of his soundtracks. I feel like Zimmer now, I'm not criticizing him because they're all bangers, but he sounds slightly lazier to me than the stuff that he was doing back in the 90s. But he's evolved the sound. Right. Still brilliant. His best score is probably The Last Samurai. It's a very underrated score. Anyway,
this is good intel. I'm going to go back and do some listening. Okay, All right, this one's less of an A or B. You're walking in a desert alone in the sand and all of a sudden you look down and you see a tortoise. You reach down, you flip the tortoise on its back.
What is what's a tortoise?
Do you know what a turtle is?
Yeah.
It's like a turtle.
I've never seen one. But I know what you mean.
The tortoise lays on its back, its belly baking in the hot sun. You're not helping it. Why is that? These are just questions. Describe in a single word the only good things to come to your mind about your mother.
My mother. Let me tell you about my mother.
Beautiful. Yeah. You passed. You're a replicant.
Did I pass the vibe check?
Yeah.
That absolutely passes, yeah.
Very good. Very good.
I feel like I've learned more than I ever have in a rapid fire question.
Yeah, that was good. Were you taking notes, Tristan? I got Last Samurai and Broken Arrow in my two key takeaways to have a listen to.
And, well, to be fair, you know, it's reciprocated because you taught Edward all about Sally Field.
Yeah.
It's a good exchange of ideas and knowledge there.
Everyone wins.
Everybody wins.
Especially the listeners.
The friends of the show at home. Yeah.
Some very, very niche takeaway stuff you can go and have fun with now.
We thrive in the niche.
Exactly.
And the other real nerd fact, if you like nerd score music score facts, is that the Scream 2, they used a bit of Broken Arrow as a temp cue when they were editing to the for the love scene, the love sort of motif between Dewey and Gale Weathers, and it's that low guitar that goes bong 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 bong, and it worked so well they just kept it in. So a bit of Broken Arrow is in Scream 2. So if you love that bong 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 bong,
I do love
you will
that.
Absolutely love. You will love the Broken Arrow score because it's just that all over it. It's brilliant and loads of really high octane action music as well. That's just absolutely perfect.
Oh man!
So there you go.
So I feel like we know you extremely well now. We're ready to talk about movies comfortably. This was 1982, big year for films, big year for synth, big year for sci-fi, I suppose. We had E.T., the biggest film in the world. We had Tootsie in there. Is that sci-fi? Maybe. Maybe.
I don't know.
Possibly not. An Officer and a Gentleman, Gandhi, First Blood, Rocky III, Poltergeist, Porky's. Tron,
ah,
big one. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, with the most annoying soundtrack. Not the original, of course, but the one in that film specifically, that jingle. Oh, that's so annoying. Important Halloween. Man, but there was a little film, fell somewhere outside the top 10, probably outside the top 20. It was a slight box office disappointment. A little film about
The Birth of Greg Carney?
Oh, 82. You're an 82, man. I forgot about that. Yeah. Okay.
I've said it now.
We've captured it. Now, there was a film, Greg, a little film that came out that year.
Yes.
About a man.
Yes.
Or is he?
Mm-hmm.
A little film called Blade Runner. So Blade Runner came out in June of 1982, budget of $30 million with a box office of $41.6 million. So, you know, it didn't lose money, I guess. And then, you know, it cleaned up in the DVD era, I'm sure. Rotten Tomatoes scores, critic score 89%, audience score 91%, critic consensus as follows. Misunderstood when it first hit theaters, the influence of Ridley Scott's mysterious neo-noir Blade Runner has deepened with time. A visually remarkable, achingly human sci-fi masterpiece.
Ooh, not bad.
Wow.
Achingly.
It's the most glowing critic consensus I think we've ever seen on this podcast.
Hmm.
You know, they don't usually write those for Van Damme films.
No. I mean, we do.
We are really tapping into tier one films with this miniseries. We're hitting some classics. This is no exception.
That is correct.
Was this a big movie for you, Greg, in the year of your birth?
It was not, no. I was never a big Blade Runner guy. I didn't see it in 82. But as I got a bit older, I was a huge Harrison Ford fan as well as a kid, especially, you know, this movie was called Blade Runner. It had the word Blade and Runner in the title.
That's true.
What could go wrong? Cool. And, yeah, and it had Indiana Jones at the same time. What could possibly go wrong? But I didn't dig it. It was just probably a bit beyond me, well, honestly, until probably the rewatch for this pod. So I remember trying to watch it again. I'm probably in my maybe early 20s, mid 20s, something like that. And it just wasn't my jam, which is I've come full, not full circle. I've 180'd, and we'll get in on that on the rewatch.
Yeah, don't go full circle.
It just wasn't. Yeah, I didn't go full circle. Half circle, the other direction, as it were. So no, in summary, no.
What about The Sunglass Kid? Where was the, obviously we've talked about it's your favourite film, but where did it all begin for you with this one?
I think I remember seeing it. I certainly didn't see it at the cinema. I'd have been one. But I remember being in one night, it must have been the 90s, it was shown on UK television, and I was on my own in the living room, and it came on TV, and it might come on quite late as well. And I remember being young enough to not maybe be probably know who Harrison Ford was. Like, I recognized him, but and I just remember the atmosphere of it being so like cool. And I struggled to follow like a couple of bits of it, but I generally followed the whole thing. And I remember finding it so like expansive and massive, and just not understanding like how anything was being done. I think as like a kid, you see these like, and then as an adult, you look at it and you go, I'm still kind of can't understand how some of the stuff's done. Even then, when you watch the making ofs and everything, and you're like,
100%.
The opening shot of Blade Runner with the massive cityscape, and it's like 200 miles of LED lights or something. I discovered that was done entirely in camera. They were literally filming it, then on like a lot locked off on like a track, then resetting and exposing over the same film for different things. So the flames are done, then the lights are done. So it's all done actually on the same one bit of film. Mm. And it looks so good. Like, and so I think it's so manual. Yeah, it's super manual. Yeah. And so I remember thinking,
so much could go wrong.
And I just remember loving that noir-y thing. I think I was like 11 or 12, maybe 13 even. And around that same time, there was like a load of like films I started discovering, like 60s, like spy films, like Dip Chris Farrell, Michael Caine and things like that. So I was very much into, and I got into playing detectives as a kid in school, like, you know, as a 10-year-old nice. Boy playing spies and stuff. So I loved that whole noir-y kind of cool thing. And just, yeah, I remember just being absolutely blown away by it. And I can't remember to this day whether I think it was the director's cut that I saw, because I remember the unicorn bit and being like,
right,
what's going on in that one moment. But it was awesome. And I must have seen the film 150 times minimum.
Really?
Yeah, minimum.
Yeah, wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn. Well, this was a big one for me. In a weird way, like, I watched it a lot when I first watched it and hadn't really watched it since.
How old were you then?
It was year 12. I guess I was 16, 17. And we had to study it for English as part of the...
Of course.
As part of the school year.
The curriculum.
The syllabus. The curriculum.
What?
Maybe it was year 11. I'm not totally
fun,
sure.
Fun
whatever.
English class were you doing? We study Blade Runner. That's media studies territory, right, isn't it?
Yeah. It's pretty fucking cool, right? And this is the thing as well. So that film, that class, that teacher, all those things together, it is honestly one of those things in my life that I can trace back a lot of who I am now to that class. The teacher was fucking awesome. And this film was the first film, I guess, that I saw and someone explained to me, like, unpacked it for me, basically, right? Like, I think it was the first time I realized, oh, wait, so there's more than just, like, you know, the surface level stuff going on here. And he created a monster, let's be honest, because then I became, you know, film student Tristan, who is someone I like to make fun of today. But, you know, a real pretentious teenager thinking, you know, oh, Steven Spielberg's too mainstream. You know, like that was the whole thing, right? But man. And then I studied it again at uni because it was a film subject. So I was technically sort of a film student. But we did this subject that was about, it was called Literature and the Screen. And so you'd do the book and the movie. You'd study both. So we did that. So then I read the book for the first time, which I don't remember a lot of, to be honest. But I remember liking it. So yeah, this movie has always been like a really academic, I guess, part of my life. I've rarely watched it for fun. Not that I didn't like it or anything, but you know, we watched it a lot.
You watched it with a critical eye.
Yeah. So it almost felt like work to watch it again. So I just never really went back to it for a long time. I think I maybe watched it maybe 10 years ago or something again, but I watched it this week for the first time in a long time. And I watched the final cut. But also shout out to Mr. Smalls, my English teacher. If you're out there, you're the best.
Wait, your English teacher is called Mr. Smalls?
Yeah.
That's funny because one of my film tutors at film school was called Andy Smalls, who showed us loads of crazy films on a Friday morning.
Yeah.
Because I actually went to film, like I was actually predominantly the course was filmmaking, so I could shoot, we shot on 16mm. But
oh, hell yeah.
But on the Friday mornings, because we had other modules to make it a kind of academic, partially academic course, and Andy Smalls would bring in 35mm prints of like random experimental movies and like kind of early movies. Like
that's cool.
I think he showed us the first Polanski film, Cul-de-Sac, on like a 35mm. print and things like that. So we,
that's awesome.
And everyone was at Thursday nights were a big drinking night in our union bar, so everyone was just absolutely like hanging watching like all this crazy shit on 35. Just yeah, it was a weird morning.
Well, shout out to that Mr. Smalls.
Yeah, shout out
Smalls.
To all the, all, legends all, the, all the Smalls, Mr. and Miss and Ms. and Mrs. Smalls teachers, especially
Biggie Smalls, greatest teacher of them all,
Biggie Smalls.
Oh, yeah, the only other thing with this movie is for the longest time, I didn't realize that Sean Young was also in Ace Ventura. I didn't make the connection.
Yeah, she's very quite different in that.
Until, yeah, man.
How would you like me to very make your so. Life a living hell? Well, Lois, I'm not quite ready for a relationship yet.
Your gun is digging into my head.
Ace Ventura is probably the only film I've seen more than Blade Runner. I know that film literally line for line.
That movie I had recorded off TV at some point when I was a kid, and I literally just watched it on repeat.
Yeah.
And I'm terrified to revisit it because I know there's stuff in there that ain't going to hold up.
Still awesome.
I guess it's a time capsule, yeah. All right, should I get into the origin story of this film?
Please.
Origin story.
Okay, so as we mentioned, this is based on a book by Philip K. Dick, came out in 1968 called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Great name. I love these long title sci-fi names, and it bums me out that the movies don't keep them.
Total Recall, missed opportunity.
What was Total Recall called? Oh, We Can Remember It Wholesale. For You Wholesale. Yeah. And then the one that AI was based on, the Spielberg one, was called like, what was it called?
I couldn't remember that.
That's Super Toys for Summer or something.
Yeah.
It was something long.
Something about.
I love the long Summer names. Yeah, bring them back.
Clearly less memorable.
Yeah. Right. It's a good point.
Yeah.
I think we just proved why they don't call them
I
that.
Think so.
Yeah. Okay, so Mr. Dick came up with the idea for this book.
No relation to Andy Dick, apparently. I tried to check that out.
No relation.
No relation. Weird.
Next you'll be telling me my Mr. Smalls and Sunglasses Kid Mr. Smalls are not related. Yeah. And
I was kind of hoping you were going to say his first name was Andy and there was going to be some bizarre way that your English teacher emigrated to London and started lecturing in.
Stranger things have happened.
They have.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Philip K. Dick also wrote The Man in the High Castle. And when he was researching that, he got access to all kinds of Nazi stuff and including like, I guess they weren't diaries. I don't know what they were, paperwork, logs, whatever, of the Gestapo. And just reading the shit that they wrote, he just couldn't believe how cold-hearted these people were and thought, these people can't be human. Like what, who can, you know, think like this and be so cold? Like it was things like, oh, we're kept awake at night by the screams of starving children. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Ugh. So I guess that just planted the seed in his head of, you know, what does it mean to be human? Is there another type of human? Like what makes us us, et cetera, et cetera. And then I guess dotted line to enter his dream of electric sheep. So the book comes out and immediately gets attention from the folks in Hollywood. And actually the first major director to be interested was Mr. Martin Scorsese.
Ah.
If you can believe it.
Dude, that's two. You just dropped me with two facts I didn't know. I didn't know the Nazi thing and I didn't know the Scorsese thing as well.
Boom. All right.
Wow.
Is this his first Hollywood film?
He'd done it. Oh, wait, who? Ridley?
Philip.
I think it was first, the first.
This is his first adaptation.
Film.
Adaptation?
I believe so. Yeah
cool.
Sorry. Started the craze.
Yes.
But yeah, Scorsese was interested. Would have been happy to see a Joe Pesci, Ray Batty, but I guess that's for another universe to see.
Oh, man.
That would have been something. Like,
De Niro as Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Actually, no, sure. It should have been Pacino as Blade Runner.
Yeah. You flip the tortoise.
Yeah. Look at me. Look at me. Yeah. Look at a fucking void comp test.
Okay, so Hollywood were interested. Martin Scorsese didn't do it for whatever reason. But a few other people were interested. People started writing scripts. It was all hit and miss, a few false starts. One of the initial scripts that somebody wrote was so shitty that Philip K. Dick apparently said to him, shall I beat you up here at the airport or shall I beat you up back at my apartment?
Ooh.
Philip K. Dick is not who I thought he was, just based on some of these things I've been reading. He sounds
angry.
Fun.
Also, I like the origin story let's just dive a little bit into this, Philip K. Dick. You were just reading Nazi literature. Why was that?
Yeah.
Just for research. Reading some Nazi stuff.
On the bus, sitting there with a copy of Mein Kampf.
Yeah. As you
do. One way to keep the seat to yourself.
It's true. That's what Larry, have you seen in the last season of Curb Your Enthusiasm? He starts wearing a Make America Great Again hat.
I haven't seen it, but I heard about that.
Leave him alone. I can't remember. Was it so no one sat next to him? I think it was. Yeah, perfect. So there you go, Greg. Yeah. You're getting there. all right. So then another writer enters the picture by the name of Hampton Fancher. Don't know much about him. I looked him up. He'd written some things. Most notable things were he was a writer on Blade Runner 2049. So I guess that's kind of his thing. His version of the script caught the eye of producer Michael Dealy. Michael Dealy was tight with Ridley Scott. So this is where Ridley Scott starts to come in. Although initially, you know, he's made Alien at this point, his hot property. Initially he was already booked and he had to say no to Blade Runner because he was making Dune. He was making Dune.
Oh, yeah, ah. Right.
So apparently he spent a year working on that, I guess pre-production. And then his brother died unexpectedly, not Tony Scott. So I guess he had two brothers.
Oh, what?
Jeez. What? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so he just decided to call it. And then David Lynch took over that one. And then this came along and he's like, you know what? Yeah, I'll do this one. I can't explain why, but I guess it was just one of those things that just felt less hectic maybe for his current state.
Yeah.
But he joins in 1980 essentially. He liked it, but he did ask for rewrites. Apparently that script was more focused on the environmental issues and less so the what does it all mean? And he wanted more of that in there. And the film had another title. I can't remember what it was now, but it wasn't Blade Runner. And the phrase Blade Runner is not in the book at all. It was actually just the name of another book that he liked. And so they bought the rights to the name. It's a book by Alan E. Norse called The Blade Runner.
Yeah, it's a cool name.
Completely unrelated.
It's weird. In a way, it's weird. It's like one of those movie titles like Reservoir Dogs where it doesn't really say anything. Yeah, it sounds cool.
Yeah.
Like what is a Reservoir Dog? It just evokes something, but it doesn't mean anything. It's like...
Good point, man.
Why would you call like replicant hunting blade running? But it sort of sounds right.
Yeah, yeah. Man, don't question it. But if you do, it makes no sense.
It's a good point. I feel the same way about logos. You know how anytime there's a new logo, there's always backlash. It's like, what? That's so random. Why would you have that logo? All logos are fucking random, and they become meaningful over time. So I agree. I think the Blade Runner principle is the same deal.
Hey, just
what does
on
it mean?
That.
No one knows what it means. It's provocative.
What if we swapped the titles between Blade Runner and Reservoir Dogs? If that film was called The Blade Runners and this film was called Reservoir Dogs.
Well, he does have a blade. Cut someone's ear off.
Reservoir Dogs, they're all running blades. And this film, there's a lot of reservoir-y vibes. And you could, you know, there could be a...
I feel like
it would make more sense if you were going to flip them, if Reservoir Dogs is renamed to Blade Runners and Blade Runner is renamed to Reservoir Dog. That might work. But yeah, I can't imagine it not being Blade Runner.
Well, they could do a recut. They're due for another recut of this film, so maybe they just change the title.
Ugh, no more fucking cuts.
I like that name because is Deckard a Reservoir Dog? Is he simply following his master's orders and he has no, you know.
I mean, I feel like the runner bit makes sense because he's sort of running after them and they're running from him, and the blades are like an evocative word that sort of things are on a knife edge, on an edge or something. There's something about it that just instinctively just sounds good.
It's a great phrase.
It works. That book apparently was also sci-fi, but it was about illegal medical services or some kind of underground
scalpels.
Medical stuff. Yeah, scalpels and such. Scalpel runner. So he then hired another writer by the name of David Peoples to come in and rewrite, who I guess added more of the human-y mindfuckery elements because this dude also wrote 12 Monkeys.
Ah.
I think I love 12 Monkeys. I haven't watched that in a long time, but I'm pretty sure that's awesome. Could be wrong.
I saw it once and remember not being particularly enamored with it, but one I need to rewatch because that doesn't feel like enough to judge it on.
I think I liked the time travel theory of it, which I won't get into now just in case. No spoilers. All right, so that happens. We've got a new script. Things are moving. We're on set. But guess what? We're shooting 50 nights in a row and everyone's getting a little unpleasant with each other. Not the least of which being Mr. Ridley Scott and Mr. Harrison Ford. They had some tension. But it seems like everyone had tension with everybody because he was annoyed at Ridley Scott. It seems like, from what I was reading, it seems like Ridley Scott as a director, at least at that point on that movie, wasn't giving much to the actors. I think there was a bit of, all right, so what's my character? Like, what do you want me to do? And he's like, yeah, go figure it out. So these actors were kind of left to their own devices to kind of, you know, build up their shit, which I think maybe is a tactic because it kind of worked. But anyway, more on that later. But he was very particular about the world and the sets and everything. So on the one hand, he's pissing off all the actors by not giving them much attention. And on the other hand, he's pissing everyone else off by giving them too much attention. Like apparently he would walk into a big set like Tyrell's big room or whatever after, you know, they've built this epic thing and he'll just ask them to flip the pillars around the other way.
they had got them the wrong way around, according to Scott, from what I recall. But he was an art director, I think, before he was a director because he worked in commercials in the UK. And alongside his brother, Tony. But reminds me as well a bit. I was watching a making of Terminator, the first Terminator, the other day, and him and Cameron are quite similar beasts in that they're quite, they kind of forget about the actors in favor of kind of concentrating on set pieces and ambience and angles, and they famously are like, you know, quite hardcore and kind of piss off actors who feel like they're being kind of moved around like props rather
yeah,
than.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say they're almost like chess pieces, but yeah, like props, basically. I don't know. We'll talk about, I guess we can talk about it when we get into the movie, but I don't know. The results speak for themselves, in my opinion. Oh, but I do have a quote from Harrison Ford about Ridley Scott here. What did he say? He said, Blade Runner is not one of my favorite films. I tangled with Ridley. but he also talks about like the, I guess the people that pissed him off even more than Ridley Scott were the actual suits and the producers and such. Cause then he says, when we started shooting it, it had been agreed that the version of the film that we had agreed upon was the version without voiceover. It was a fucking nightmare. I thought the film had worked without the narration, but now I was stuck recreating that narration and I was obliged to do the voiceovers for people that did not represent the director's interest. I went kicking and screaming to the studio to record it. Not happy at all.
No. Yeah, I'd heard that, well, that you read deliberately read it badly.
Came through in the performance, yeah. you might argue.
He's such a funny guy, like because when you see him interviewed and stuff, he kind of is as deadpan as that. And part of me wonders, like, has he just embraced the narrative that he wasn't trying because he wasn't into it, or was he just?
I don't think it sounds that bad. I think it sounds exactly like what they were going for, which is a kind of Philip Marlowe detective noir-y thing.
Well, that's the thing, right?
Yeah,
and he's reading it. If you watch any like of those like old detective movies, they all sound like that. They're all like,
yeah.
I was walking down a street and some guy came up to me and handed me a book of matches. That's exactly how Ford delivers all the lines.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's funny because on the one hand, it does work as a noir trope, but I think it's just the actual dialogue itself just feels so.
I kind of like it. I like the. What's weird is when you watch the director's cut without the voiceover, you remember the information that you get from the voiceover. So when like Vass comes up to him and is like talking into him and in like a street language, you now know that it's a mashup of different languages, and you know that Deckard understands what he's saying and is pretending not to, but you only know that because it comes from the voiceover of the theatrical cut.
That's interesting. You know what they should do? They should just have all of these as options.
They do. I mean, there's the mega box set you can get that's got all of them. But yeah, you should have them all on a one thing where you can
just in terms of just on a remote, like add VO.
Well, look, I'm as Tristan knows, I quite often add subtitles when I'm watching an English film.
Yeah,
which was a volume issue when I had an infant, but I've kind of stuck with it now. It's a bit of a habit. A bad habit.
Hey, don't worry. Gen Z do it too.
I can't.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm very Gen Z. I get that a lot. Sorry?
You can, it wrecks films because you can see what they're about to say before they've said it.
Yeah, it's not good. It was good for The Wire.
That's where it started for a lot of people, I think. Yeah. Putting subtitles on for The Wire.
Yeah, it was helpful. But I had a Thailand copy and it only had subtitles. I couldn't turn them off, but it probably did help in that instance.
Thailand DVDs, that was an era. Very distinct era. all right, pre-casties. So, you know, it wasn't always Harrison Ford in the driver's seat here, running with blades and such. It was Robert Mitchum was the original muse for writer Fancher. There was also talk of Dustin Hoffman, but he bailed.
Went to Tootsie by the sounds of it.
That would have been a different movie. Oh, yeah, he was busy Tootsieing. Good point, good point. But there was a young man named Harrison Ford who'd obviously been in Star Wars, just wrapped on Indiana Jones. Well, at that time, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
So hot right now.
Yeah. And he was hot property, but he wanted to do something different, something with a little bit of depth, according to him. And so, you know, he's in. There was a longer list I came across, but it's one of those long lists where it's like
everyone
just
list
every popular actor of the time.
Tom Cruise.
Gene Hackman, Sean Connery, Jack Nicholson. Paul Newman, Clint Eastwood, Tommy Lee Jones. Tommy Lee Jones would have been pretty good.
I actually reckon of all of them, Dustin Hoffman could have had a run at it.
It would have been interesting because, I mean, Harrison Ford's hot. So just going from such a Harrison Ford type to a Dustin Hoffman type is quite a departure.
It makes more sense in like Gene Hackman would have gone too streetwise-y. Yeah. Arnie wouldn't make any sense for reasons that I can elaborate on when I get into why the hottest debated topic of Blade Runner. But Hoffman to me is someone I can imagine him, if you think of him in like Straw Dogs or something like that, and kind of he's got the vulnerability and the kind of he can do alcoholic as well. Like you think of him in like Sleepers or something. You could see him being a slightly washed up, like crappy detective who's still got an edge and a feel for things, but could also be vulnerable and get his ass kicked.
And on that note, Nick Nolte was also in the mix. Nick Nolte would have been similar kind of deal, I think.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
And Al Pacino and Burt Reynolds, apparently. But again, I mean, I guess that was probably just everyone's wish list at the time. No precasties for Roy Batty. That was always Rutger. Everyone was just like, yeah, that's the guy. Ridley didn't even meet with him before making an offer.
Why bother?
Like, I want that guy.
Why bother?
And Dick was like, fuck yeah, that is him. That's Batty. Perfect. Deborah Harry was offered the role of Priz.
Yeah.
How do you say her name? Priz?
Priz, yeah.
Whatever. Obviously went to Daryl Hannah instead. And apparently Joe Pantoliano was considered for the role of that guy that takes her in with all the creepy toys.
J.F. Sebastian.
Yeah.
Yeah, really?
Joey Pants.
That would have been interesting.
Joey Pants.
I like when Joey Pants is vulnerable.
I don't see it. I don't. I can't quite see Pants doing it.
Yeah.
I could. I could see him do anything. Yeah. He's great. He would have been less sympathetic though, probably.
Yeah.
He would have been creepier. Actually, you're right, because that whole setup is so fucking creepy that if the actor was in any way more creepy, it just would have lost that kind of... I mean, he was weird, but there was sort of some innocence to it.
He's weird. He plays him in a way that like almost like, because it's hinted that, because he's got a condition, as he's got like a genetic condition, but he's hinted as being very sort of socially awkward and kind of a bit of an oddball. So you know that she doesn't see him as a threat, and that's almost the reason that they leave him alone. You feel like if he was any kind of threat, because he's this kind of childlike, sort of slightly oddball, they kind of know, they know he's not an actual danger to them.
Yeah, being in a dark room with sort of human alive toys with Joey Pants probably would feel more threatening. Yeah.
It's a different vibe, that's for sure.
It's a different vibe.
Bish Bash Bosh, you go sell a movie. Blade Runner.
Rap party. Where's the rap party? What was that bar he went to that Sean Young wouldn't go to? Where he found
the Titty Twister?
Where Snake Girl was.
Oh, that's called Taffy Lewis's, the bar.
Taffy
there
Lewis's.
You go, Taffy Lewis.
Rap party at Taffy Lewis's.
Rap party
Lewis's.
At Taffy Lewis's.
With some octopus, baby octopus cocktails.
All right, let's play the trailer.
I need your deck. This is a bad one, the worst yet.
There was an escape from the off-world colonies 2 weeks ago. 6 replicants, 3 male, 3 female. They slaughtered 20.
A Blade Runner's job is to hunt down replicants, manufactured humans you can't tell from the real thing.
What's this?
Roy Batty, probably the leader.
There was just one outfit making replicants that superhuman, the Terrell Corporation.
Mr. Deckard, Dr. Eldon Tyrell.
I don't get it, Tyrell.
Commerce is our goal here at Tyrell. More human than human is our motto.
I was looking for 6 replicants in a city of 106 million people.
You ever see this girl, huh?
Never seen her, Buzzlove.
What I didn't know was they were looking for me.
Questions.
I just do eyes. Just genetic design. Just eyes.
That's a weird trailer. Mm. And for those listening in at home, maybe I subbed in a different trailer that's less weird. We'll never know. But Greg...
Yes.
I mean, that trailer didn't give us too much, so I feel like it's on you to give us a bit of a little recap of exactly what went down in this film.
Well, I'd be delighted. I'll be delighted. So, the distant future, 2019. As we've come to understand in this mini-series, the world has gone to shit. Our setting is a neon-lit, rainy, dark Los Angeles. The poor scurry through dirty streets while the rich live high above the clouds, out of sight and reach from poverty. The lines between humans and androids is blurred, but androids are illegal and they're shipped off to the off-world colonies as slave labour. The good people at Tyrrell's Wine have diversified into robot making and they're leading the charge in replicant manufacturing. Harrison Ford plays himself, a grumpy robot who likes to drink. He's a Blade Runner, a cop who tracks replicants Earthside and retires them. He's coerced back reluctantly for one last job, track down four missing Nexus 6 models. Along the way, he falls in love with a trans robot named Rachel, Ray Finkel. Laces out, Deckard, laces out. We're posed with questions. What defines humanity? Can robots have a soul? Who thought this film needed a voiceover for the whole thing? Etc. This is it. That's the end.
That's the end. You're gonna get me. You're gonna get me cancelled with your trans robot.
Yeah. Well, Ray Finkel, Rachel. I mean, and it's.
Oh.
What Blade Runner and Ace Ventura are in the same universe?
I
makes
I
sense.
So.
It makes no sense.
Yeah, they're both set in California.
Oh yeah, there we go.
Oh no, one's in Miami, I think, isn't it?
They're both cops.
Oh yeah, is it in Miami?
Both cops on a mission.
Yeah, there you go. Really makes you think.
Ray and Rachel, that was enough for me. And it's Sean Young. It's the same actress.
There you go.
It does. I don't know if you guys feel this. I don't know if you guys have watched like the newer Aliens films like Prometheus and Alien Covenant. It feels like they could be in the same universe.
I've got a feeling it suggested there might be some, there's some theory around like the Tyrell Corporation and the Wayland Corporation being somehow connected.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because they make androids, right? So... there's something
and wine,
some overlap there, and the newer ones are pretty much, you know, all about the android. Really.
Although, like I was saying just before we started recording, that I just when I was rewatching, just quickly watching a Blade Runner making of thing, realizing, hang on a minute, replicants aren't androids.
Yeah,
they're human. They're like genetically enhanced humans. They're kind of closer to like a clone. They're more like a clone than they're not Terminator. They're not a robot underneath.
Well, that's it. When they human skin. Get shot, they bleed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had the same thing. Like, is this artificial intelligence at all? Because they're not robots. They're organic. They're more just like, yeah, like clones or really sophisticated test tube babies.
Like the closer thing to them is like the movie The Island, which I think is a kind of, bit of a rip-off of Logan's Run. But, like, The Island has a premise where they're kind of organically grown humans that are actually technically have the mind of a baby.
Yeah.
And then they're kind of schooled up and farmed for... because they're a clone of a human in real life who's...
Yeah, if I need a new heart or whatever, I just go
exactly.
Rip it out of my clone.
But it's better to think of them a replicant as that. Because I think it's too easy to start thinking of Rutger Hauer as like Terminator when he's actually not.
Yeah, but they are super strong. Also, I don't even remember where I read this, so maybe take it with a grain of salt. But there was apparently a version of the script where even Tyrell was a replicant, and so when Roy kills him, his skull opens up or whatever and it's just wires and shit in there, which would say the fact that there's wires and stuff in there would suggest that they are robots.
Well, it's confusing
because the older version.
The book's called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Yeah.
But I've actually not read the book. So it's, even though I'm a super fan of the movie, I've left the book alone.
Mm.
But I think because it was called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep and it never explicitly... It, I mean, when you think about it, it does talk about like the sort of genetics of it. Because when Batty's like interrogating Tyrell, he's sort of he's when he's like, "I want more life." Tyrell was sort of saying, "Oh, we tried this and we tried that," and like then the genes mutate and it leads to diseases and stuff. So that all the stuff he's talking about is sort of genetics, not we couldn't get a battery to last that long or anything like that. He's not talking about like mechanical stuff. He's talking about biology
and the test. It's all about empathy and all that kind of shit. Like, it's not just a metal detector.
Yeah, although, like, you feel like, because there's a similarity to something like Terminator that's got, like, dogs and there's certain, like, behaviours and things that are, like, I always sort of originally viewed it as it's just that robots can't as effectively recreate human behaviour. So if you ask it the right kind of psychological questions, a human would respond in ways that a robot wouldn't know to respond because it's tapping into some like primal psychological thing or something. It was always how I read it.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, we should ask ChatGPT those questions.
I've done that. I've been down a real rabbit hole of asking ChatGPT loads of stuff about Blade Runner, specifically his Deckard replicant. Because the other thing that suggests that they're sort of robots is the lights in their eyes.
Yeah, well, that's interesting though, because I was thinking it could be, it kind of does in like a Terminator-y kind of way. But I also think aside from Ray Finkel.
Rachel.
Is that
it's called Ray.
Aside from her, they're all pretty lively and arguably more human and life-loving than the humans. Like they're obviously desperately trying to live. They kind of act like animals, like Roy is howling like a wolf and Pris is like, you know, cartwheeling all over the place and stuff. And the light in their eyes kind of reminds me of like wild animals almost.
Yeah, you're right. They're like sort of like cats when the cat's eyes get caught in the headlights.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it kind of gave me a vibe of that, which I thought was quite cool. But yeah, the Rachel was less so. She had the eyes though. But she didn't have the life. She was kind of bland. Well, until she put her hair down, then that was.
Maybe she was designed that way.
Yeah,
but they're all odd.
Mm.
Yeah,
they all have like odd behavior to them.
Yeah, they are genuinely odd. And like Rutger Hauer, this is the first thing I ever saw him in, and it is the
Blind Fury.
Well, as a kid, you know, like I was like 17.
Oh, sorry, you meant
but he is this guy to me now. Like it's left such an impression.
Mm.
But he's odd. He's so odd.
Well, he's Dutch. Shout out to our Dutch listeners.
Yeah. Isn't that weird? Yeah. So I guess that kind of tracks. Well, hey, Greg, you had a real turnaround story on this one. Talk us through.
Well, I mean, this film's like a masterpiece. It's visually so beautiful and it's an aesthetic I didn't.
Man.
It's an aesthetic I didn't appreciate probably until maybe we've done this podcast. It wasn't really my jam, cyberpunk and such. And this is obviously
– and same as noir. You've become a bit of a noir man. Yeah.
I love noir and I didn't. And this thing is noir and it's also pioneering in that cyberpunk vibe. So it's a weird mix and it's kind of perfect.
Mm.
And I originally thought it was quite a dark film, but I think – and it is kind of dark, but it also just has tremendous use of light the whole way through.
Yeah.
But it's maybe it's used sparingly, which makes it more powerful or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But just the detail that has gone in to create this world.
Man.
Phenomenal.
It is crazy.
The story as well as the sets and the costumes. And it's just like the level of detail is gobsmacking.
It is, right?
Like the scarcity of animals, like the detail around that, replicant pets. Oh, man.
Yeah. The whole aesthetic is, just my personal taste. I love it. But the world feels real, right? And the practical stuff we were talking about before, like all that in-camera stuff, they're just, and I'm not anti-CGI, but there is just something magical about when it's all in camera. It's so tactile and your brain just gets all fuzzy. Like, how are they doing that?
Released in 82.
82, right? And I was thinking as well, like,
it's a long time ago.
Sometimes with these physical sets.
A lifetime ago, you might say.
Sometimes with these physical sets, it kind of can feel like it's, I don't know, like theater, like on it feels like a soundstage, like the older Batman movies. But even Spielberg's AI that we did a couple of weeks ago, it didn't feel like a big world. It felt like three sets, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even when they go to the city, like it felt like there was one corner of a city. Whereas this felt vast and dense and rich.
Exactly.
So much detail.
And then back it up with the themes and the way it tackles, you know, the sort of existential questions that we get weaved through these humans versus android type movies. It's it does that better than all the others. I don't know.
That's
man.
The thing. Just, it does it pretty perfectly. I know there's some thoughts brewing on this one from the Sunglass Kid quarter of the world, but I do think this movie does that whole question of human, not human, what does it mean, where's the line, better than anything else. And like when I know Westworld was a movie first, but when the Westworld TV show came out, I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I watch it and it's just like, but this is – Blade Runner already delivered that idea, not the same setting, but the whole are we mistreating – the ethical questions.
I think Westworld actually predates Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Because it was a 70s movie with Josh Brolin's dad, I think, wasn't it, originally?
Yeah. So I know the film predates, but in terms of the TV show and I guess the themes it's shooting for, it feels very, I don't know, just like the Diet Coke version of the things this movie's trying to do, you know? But yeah, you have a passionate point of view on whether Deckard is a replicant, right?
Yeah, because if you start by acknowledging that Blade Runner does an incredible job of pointing out the differences between kind of humans and android / replicant, what it is to be human, which is what if you go with K. Dick's like origin story of he's thinking about what is it to be human, right? And then this theory emerges that Deckard's a replicant, which feels entirely retrofitted onto later cuts of the movie, because the original theatrical cut doesn't hint at this at all. And then when the things that people point to are saying, like, this is evidence that Deckard's a replicant, which is famously, it's the unicorn that's shown in this dream sequence, right? Mm. And then Vass leaves this origami unicorn at the end of in the apartment.
Yeah.
But he's leaving unicorns all over the shop. He's leaving origami figures, animals, all throughout the film.
Yeah.
And in the original movie, it scans like, because you don't have that unicorn sequence in the original film. You just have an origami unicorn at the end.
Yeah.
And all it plays like is
he's been there.
That he's been there, and as a professional courtesy, he's let her live, and he'll give you a head start.
Yeah.
And it's just a unicorn's just a kind of mythical object, and it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
What about the head thing, though?
What's the head thing?
What's the head thing?
He gets his head twisted round by Pris when she does the old.
I just see that as he's just getting kind of, he just maneuvers his whole body. I don't think his head gets, I think he kind of rotates his whole body in that. But so.
Oh, does he?
So you've got the unicorn thing, and then suddenly they my theory is Scott puts out the original theatrical cut. Then the rumor or the theory, the fan theory starts that Deckard might be a replicant, and Scott likes this. So he retrofits into the director's cut this unicorn shot.
Yeah.
And he's got the footage. It's a happy accident. It's from the movie Legend that he did with Tom Cruise, right? So he inserts that B-roll footage of the Legend unicorn into it. And if you watch the scene where the unicorn thing happens, it's not shot at all like a dream sequence. It's just Harrison Ford just like slumped on the piano with his eyes open. And if they wanted to make it feel like a dream sequence, they'd do something else. Like there's plenty of places where he's like drunk and could just fall asleep. And then show it more obviously like a dream sequence. So it doesn't feel like planned, given how meticulous Scott is at directing everything. And the other thing that happens in the final cut, they insert these reflections into Ford's eyes in one scene where he's in the apartment with Rachel. They give him the replicant eyes, and it's really subtle, right?
Mm.
But when you read about the making of the film, the lights in their eyes is done in camera. It's a practical effect on set where they're reflecting a key light into their eyes. So again, if Scott always thought that Deckard was a replicant, he would have put them in.
Yeah.
So that's my theory about that. If Scott really thought of that from the get go, he would have done it from the get go. And it doesn't make any sense that Ford's a replicant, because he's the opposite. He gets his ass kicked by literally every replicant. So it'd be like, if you were going to send a replicant to catch a replicant, the replicant you'd actually send would be more like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You'd be like, okay, I'm chasing down a Roy Batty who's an enhanced super soldier. You wouldn't be like, okay, I will send this weak, inferior dude. Like, and it's implied that where Ford's strengths lie are in his human ability to sort of sniff out inhuman qualities. He can tell when someone's acting a bit iffy and a bit squiffy. Whereas replicants demonstrate they can't read. They're kind of almost like on the autistic spectrum. They can't read emotions. They don't know quite how to blend in as well. Like with the right at the start with, I forget his character name now, the one who's doing the tortoise test, Leon, right?
Leon, yeah.
So like he doesn't seem human.
As you were talking, I was trying to prepare my counter argument, but it's all pretty convincing. I think it
adds nothing. He's like an alcoholic. He drinks. He has all the traits of a human being. He gets his fingers broken by Roy Batty. He can't jump from A to B like Batty can. He gets his ass kicked by Pris. He gets his ass kicked by Zora. He gets his ass. He can do things like when he goes to Taffy Lewis after Taffy Lewis, when he's trying to track down Zora in a changing room. He's like doing an impression. He's doing like a sort of character. He's like, hey, it's the animal inspector. That doesn't feel like the abilities of a replicant. So nothing about it. And it adds nothing. It makes it a less interesting film.
I disagree that it makes it less interesting, but I don't necessarily think he is a replicant. But the fact that you could read it that way, I like. The fact that you don't know.
But it's sort of just, so like, what does it add if you make him a replicant? It adds literally nothing.
I think it adds.
It takes away, if anything.
I think it's just an extension of that main question of like, what does it mean to be human? I wouldn't think of it. I don't think that's what would make it a great movie or a shit movie though. I don't think it's like a, you know, make or break type of deal. But I do like.
The ambiguity?
And let me caveat this. I like the ambiguity, and I dislike that Ridley Scott has come out and said, Deckard is a replicant, because that just kind of ruins it for me. Like I like the ambiguity. I like Total Recall. You don't know. Is he imagining it, or, you know, is it actually just the Total Recall thing fucking him up, or did he actually unlock a true memory? I like when something can be read two different ways and they're equally valid.
To me, it doesn't feel that ambiguous. There's so many things. It's like, okay, so if he is a replicant, he's like at least the same generation as Batty, if not the next generation, which is Rachel with the human memories and stuff like that that have been implanted in. So what? He hasn't got the 4-year lifespan.
Or does he? You don't know that.
Or does he? But then there are humans he's interacting with, like the police officer at the start.
Yeah.
Who would know he was a replicant, or like, because he talks about him like he's been around for ages, like he's a former Blade Runner from years gone by. So none of it makes sense as you read him. The more you inspect the replicant theory, none of it holds up, nor does it add much to it. What's so brilliant about it, like the scene when he's having the romantic scene with Rachel, although there's a slightly rapey vibe for Ford when he's like knocking her about in the corridor and stuff. But like, even when you see the talking heads between like on that making of they watched today, they're both talking like it's this interesting dynamic between someone who's a human and a replicant who's never experienced human emotions. And it's an interesting moment. And it just doesn't, if you read it as they're two robots, I'm just like, well, okay.
Two robots who love.
Yeah, I don't know. I dig that. I don't see that as such a downer. Like I don't think he has to be a replicant. I mean, obviously it skews one way for you, but I just like the idea of the ambiguity. And I guess it is also, maybe it's a little superficial that I like the ambiguity, but I just hate, I guess a lot of new movies leave no ambiguity and just like over explain everything and like basically just say the themes in dialogue, you know? And so I like movies that leave some questions on the table, you know?
Maybe Scott came out and said that just to piss off Harrison Ford, because Harrison Ford was on the record as saying, I'm not that character's not an android. I played him straight. He was a human.
Yeah.
So he's like, oh yeah, well I'll do a remake and add in a unicorn.
I'm with Ford. I think it just scans as that. It's like, it's just all human behavior. He's got like all the traits of like addiction. Like he drinks, he's, and the qualities that you'd require to kind of track down people who are blending in and passing off as human, the skill set required is not a strength skill set. It's a psychological and like detective-y skill set.
But I just think we haven't seen anything in this world to say that can't be the case, that you can't make a replicant like that.
No, but then by that like rationale, you could be like, well, we haven't seen anything to completely disprove the idea they're not in the alien universe, and therefore that it's possible. There's loads of things that are possible that aren't explicitly like rebuked in movies.
No, I know what you're saying, but I don't know. I just disagree. I think there's validity in him being a replicant, or at least the potential for him to be a replicant. But again, not to say that I think he definitely is.
It's a nice quaint thought. It's a nice quaint thought, but I just think that's all it is. And I find it annoying that Scott like really leaned into it and sort of retrofitted it all on. But
I don't know. Yeah, I mean,
that's my theory.
I do buy into the retrofitted thing, but at the same time, like he finished that final shot minutes before he was about to get fired. Like they literally, studio were on their way to fire him. So like his vision is not in that
film.
How
do you fire him at the end?
Yeah. Well, and also you don't necessarily shoot in chronological order. So I don't know exactly how that shakes out, but that is all to say, I think it's pretty fair to say that theatrical cut was not necessarily his original intended vision, whether or not that means Deckard was always a replicant, who the hell knows. But the fact that we could even talk about it this long, I think to me, is a signal that it is interesting because we're talking about it. So I just think the fact that there are things to pick apart in a movie make it an interesting movie. This is the same thing that happened on AI. I thought I didn't like it, but as we were talking about it, I was like, fuck, the fact that we're talking about all these things makes me like it more.
I've got a couple of questions to raise. Look, these are more in the logistical bucket.
Mm-hmm.
Less existential.
Mm.
4 years for a replicant. How easy are these things to make? Because, return on investment.
Women really love each other.
Return on investment for a 4 year to get one of these high functioning clones feels a little lean.
What's the business model? Yeah.
And what about the landfill? Are they just dumping them all in outer space?
Well, I guess
are they produced locally? Are they offshoring these guys?
If they're organic matter, then I guess they're biodegradable.
Feels like it'd be good for the economy to have it manufactured on Earth side. 4 years. I just, it's like building a beautiful car that only runs for 4 years. Well, a lot more than that. That only runs for 4 years.
I've only actually seen Blade Runner 2049 once. I remember thinking I was so relieved it wasn't completely shit. I think I came out thinking it was better than it was, but in hindsight, I still think Blade Runner 2049 was almost utterly forgettable. But they have a bit where doesn't someone get cut out of some sort of
womb thing,
right? And it's hinted in a way, like I say, going back to a movie like The Island, where they're sort of being mass grown in sort of like artificial kind of. Yeah, like
pods.
Yeah, wombs. Yeah, pods type thing. Yeah. I suppose you could imagine something like that. But
It's funny you say forgettable because I was about to say I can't remember. I guess that means it's forgettable. But I remember liking it. I watched it at the cinema, and it was pretty and it sounded good. And I thought I liked it a lot, but I've never had the urge to revisit.
It's unlike Blade Runner, where if I said to you, can you think of a quote, can you think of a scene from Blade Runner? you're not struggling to think. You're eliminating all the scenes that come to mind immediately because you've got so many. There's so many great moments in Blade Runner. Everything's eminently quotable, and there's so many great set pieces. And then you think of Blade Runner 2049, and you're like, there's a bit at the start with like a crash and some guy, and then there's something to do with like a there's a bit with some water.
I just remember Batista wearing really little glasses. I thought that was cool.
Oh, that was a cool that was cool opening. He was great.
And Gosling had a cool jacket, and that's all I remember.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you're thinking of Drive.
Oh. Well, that, no, that's his thing. He has a cool jacket in
Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah. Is it as cool as the Drive jacket
nah,
with the snake?
Don't be silly.
Snake or scorpion? Scorpion.
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 Scorpion. Well, where does it land? Where does it land, like, lore-wise in 2049? Like, is Deckard officially a replicant in that one? Is Gosling a replicant? I think he is.
Yeah, he is. I found the plot a little bit unintelligible.
Yeah.
I just felt like it was a slightly unnecessary. Like, if ever there was a Blade Runner sequel, it would, if they had made like a Blade Runner sequel 2 years or 3 years after Blade Runner, the greatest, like, almost obvious slam dunk sequel would have been Deckard and Rachel on the off-world colony being hunted down by the police.
Yeah.
And blending into a kind of future that looks like Elysium or something.
Yeah.
And having to then go back to Earth or something and make it a full chase scene. And it could have played out like Bourne Supremacy if you want to get rid of Rachel in the first sequence, have her, you know, killed and then dead chasing down Deckard and just make it like Bourne. It would have been brilliant.
Yeah, that's cool.
But the 2049, I just found it this like sturgy.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, style over substance, perhaps.
Just couldn't. There was something about Ryan Gosling finding a wooden memento of something that he buried somewhere, and something about him being related to some. It was all just tedious, kind of like.
Oh yeah, this sort of, wait, did the replicants have a kid? Yeah.
He had a child or something, or he was Harrison Ford's kid. I couldn't remember, but it was all this sort of, I just remember thinking, oh wait, replicants can have relationships now. It's
just, oh yeah, no, there was something cool in it, I think, where, oh, man, I can't remember, so I'm going to butcher this, but I think there was some kind of layer to it where it was kind of alluding to him being some kind of special guy, and then he wasn't. He was just.
Yeah.
I kind of like that, but I can, like, in saying that, I can barely remember, but. Yeah,
Blade Runner is just the beauty of it is its simplicity. That it's ultimately it's just someone tracking down tracking down some people and killing them.
And also, I didn't realize how late it is by the time Batty shows up. He's basically not in it until like almost the third act.
Mm.
But you don't remember it that way because he's so fucking good.
See, he comes in around halfway mark, doesn't he? Because he's going around asking questions at the eye with the eye guy.
He goes see James Hong. And,
oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah, he does show up earlier. Yeah. I forgot about that part.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does.
He's a kind of menacing background.
Yeah. That's true.
Great scene.
There are some seeds. James Hong, man. How many movies? We should just do a whole James Hong podcast. Yeah.
He's in Big Trouble in Little China, right?
Yeah.
Is he also in Tango and Cash, or am I thinking of another guy who's a similar character actor to him?
I think that is him in Tango and Cash. He's in
Wayne's World 2 as well, right?
I mean, at the time, right, there weren't many.
It's Cassandra's dad.
You had to just, yeah, like that was the only Asian actor they let
James
in.
James Hong or bust.
Yeah. He started a whole like Asian actor community. He's a legend.
He's a legend.
Yeah.
Still going. He was in the extremely loud, unbearably confusing film.
Everything Everywhere All at Once, yeah.
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 Thank you.
Hey, you know how we're just talking about, oh, they're not androids, they're organic matter. I was thinking though, because it did throw me into an existential crisis, like, oh no, we're supposed to be doing AI movies. Does this count? There was actually an interesting AI thing in the film, little unexpected AI, which is the famous scene where he's like,
enhanced 224 to 176.
You know, zooming in on the photos and such, has always been held up as that would never be possible. But actually with AI now, I'm not saying it would be accurate, but with AI now, like you can zoom in and the picture becomes clear. You can, you know, add, you know, see things that weren't in the original photo. Not that they would actually be there, I guess. But I thought it was an interesting little nugget.
There's definitely like tech in tech. The longer we go on, the more the tech that seemed like far-fetched.
Yeah.
Like you've got camera phones.
Yeah.
Like he calls Rachel from a camera phone in Taffy Lewis's bar.
Of course.
Yeah.
Like a he does FaceTime with her.
Yeah, exactly.
I just love, Greg and I have talked about this many, many times, so sorry, Greg, but I just fucking love 80s version of the future because they have video phones, but it's still a big, ugly, boxy thing with like buttons and knobs and like, you know, all this shit's too sleek. Like this phone is just like I want like green lights on my keys and stuff, you know.
The movie that like predicts, like to tangent it, that predicts a lot of tech really well is Demolition Man. Demolition Man's got like
it had iPads, self-driving
cars,
yeah.
iPads, camera phones,
rat burgers,
cancel culture.
Yeah.
It's got like literally if we're amazing. It's got like head like a dis, like a dystopian utopia where no one's allowed to eat anything that's bad for them. No one's allowed to swear. No one's allowed to have any kind of independent thought.
All the songs are jingles. Yeah.
All the songs are boring. It's like, it's such a brilliantly like, it's up there. It's one of my favorite sci-fis actually.
Do we have the shells? Do you have a theory on the shells?
Oh yeah.
Apparently they're, some say it's like you sort of, it's scraping.
Yeah, I didn't, some sort of pitch.
I don't, I liked it better than I just thought they're like three like buttons that activate something on the toilet and you just,
yeah,
it's just not intuitive or something to people. Yeah. Like the grimmer explanation for it.
You know what? I stand by my point. Another brilliant sci-fi movie that leaves you with questions. You know, what are the shells for? What are the shells for?
Yeah.
Yeah,
maybe exactly. Potentially a more profound question than whether Deckard is a replicant. Yeah. Oh, we should explore tropes. For each of these miniseries, we try and like look at tropes of, you know, the genre. For this, it is more, I guess, just like setting and some of the details around the AI itself. So depictions of the future, I think we're very much in a cyberpunk dystopia here. Aesthetically wonderful, probably horrible to live in. Human extinction, not really an issue in this one yet.
It's kind of overpopulation is what it's hinting at, because everyone needs to get off Earth and get onto the off-world colony. Yeah. And it's definitely predicted like the super rich live up high and the poor live down below, which is explored in things like Judge Dredd as well.
The I think the book goes into elaborate that humans are encouraged to move off world by being given a replicant. So you can leave and go and live in the outer colonies and we'll give you a replicant. That was like the part of the deal in the book. That's all I got on that.
I like.
It's all the other, on a trope thing. I don't know if it's classified as a trope, but it's one of my observations about Harrison Ford and his hand acting. Harrison Ford does a lot of acting with his hands. And I seem to notice in a lot of 90s and 80s and 90s Harrison Ford films, there's always a scene where Harrison Ford's doing that with his hand.
This. I can picture like him pointing a lot too. That's probably something.
He does a lot of pointing, but he does a lot of this with his hand when he's like putting his hand at, like he does it in like, when he gets like knocked out or something, his hands all go a bit funky when he's trying to find. And he does it in like Indiana Jones and a bunch of other
I've
movies.
Never noticed it.
Interesting.
It's just what I call my Harrison Ford hand acting.
Yeah.
He's on full hand acting form in Blade Runner.
He's a hands man. Wasn't he a carpenter or something?
He was a carpenter, the
moneymaker's right there. Yeah. Robots bad or humans bad or both?
Ooh.
I mean, the replicants, we haven't really talked about yet. They weren't really bad.
They're just trying to stay alive.
They just wanted to live, man.
Not as killing as many people as Neo.
Yeah. We did The Matrix last week and we were both a little shocked at how many people Neo and Trinity kill that aren't agents. Like after they've explained that, you know, if you die in The Matrix, you die in the real world. These people are just there thinking they're doing their jobs and some guy in a trench coat comes in and blows them away.
Yeah, right. They are actually killing people because somehow they sort of try and lightly justify it as, well, okay, now you agree it's in a virtual world, then anything goes, and it doesn't, you know, they're not really killing people. But they've also said, no, but you actually do really die in your pod. So they actually really are killing people.
I think you're dying.
So Roy killed less people than Neo, and he, you know, he just wanted to live. He wanted to save his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Did this film build the case for AI love? That probably depends. If you think Deckard's a replicant, maybe. But also, well, just Roy.
And, Rachel loves back. Is that the question?
I think it's the weirdest bit in Blade Runner. It's the bit that gives me the most sort of like, it's the bit, I remember when I first saw it going, what the hell's going on here? Now Harrison Ford's slamming the door and not letting her out. And he looks really angry. And he's like shoving against the wall and saying, say, love me, say, kiss me.
That's a good impression.
Like, what the fuck? Why is he suddenly turned into like a slightly kind of like, what the hell's going on here? And I always think that's like just a very old, unusual note about it.
I was thinking it might be like
Hollywood.
Hollywood. Now also him, I guess, wrestling with, can I treat her just like an object because she is just a fake human, and then being kind of weird about it. I mean, it does stand out. It's
or
weird.
Like he's
it's
maybe, icky. Or maybe he's like, he's trying to sort of like, there's maybe a suggestion that he's kind of trying to sort of snap her out of it or get her in, make her feel something by doing something like slightly extreme. But there's something about it that's a bit weird.
Just needed some detective noir narration there.
Yeah.
I got a little rapey because I needed her to let me in. The wench wouldn't talk.
Yeah.
I had to put her in her place. But Roy
clap.
And Pris, like Roy seems to love her, right? When she dies, he kisses her tongue back into her mouth.
Yeah, that's weird.
And then also he doesn't kill Deckard. I think there is signals of potential to love there, I would argue. And then Greg, let's not forget this one. AI Bechdel test. Do any AIs talk to each other about anything other than humans? Again, maybe depends. I think they do. This has got to be the closest out of any that we've done so far. If Deckard is a replicant, then they definitely do. But if not, but
just even
maybe
the
not.
Even the Nexus 6 numbers, surely.
Yeah.
One of the chats they have is about.
Wait, what? I know what the Bechdel test is, but hang on. What are we asking? Do any of the replicants talk about anything?
We've just subbed in gender for artificial intelligence. So are there any characters? Are there two characters in this film who are AI with names who talk to each other about anything other than a human?
Yes.
Yeah.
You've got it's Batty and I can't remember which one it is when they're it's Batty and Pris talking about either Zora or Leon not making it. They have a conversation about where's another one of them, and they're like,
and he says there's just the two of us now or whatever. Yeah.
So it's just the two of us now.
Yeah.
They have that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Fact.
Ding.
There you go. First one to pass. We thought it would be funny if we do this because I'd say there's a chance that there's maybe more films that pass the AI Bechdel test than just the regular Bechdel test. That will be telling. Well, I don't know. Guys, should we just get into the verdict? We've covered a lot of ground here and Greg's got a work day to start any minute.
I've got a meeting pretty soon.
Okay, let's get into verdict.
I don't know what to say, really. I don't remember asking you a goddamn thing.
The law.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
I want to have them answered immediately.
You can't handle the truth.
What are you waiting for, huh?
Say what again?
Nothing further,
Your Honor.
And that's all I have to say about that.
All right. Big picture, guys. Does this film hold up? It's a yes from me.
Definite yes for me. From my viewing experience, it's you know, this has catapulted itself into, you know, favorite film territory potentially.
Yeah.
probably not number one, but, you know, Sunglasses Kid referenced, I have a slate of favourites, so this could potentially be in the mix. It's pretty special.
Yeah, this is...
I think it, yeah. Like, it not only does it hold up, but it's going to be like a fine wine that it's going to get more and more relevant, because I think of all the futures,
yeah,
that you can sort of foresee coming, it was kind of one of those early ones to do with a kind of dystopian grungy future, and it feels very like it's heading in that direction. It's predicted, yeah, a lot of tech, and I feel like the genetic stuff and androidy and AI stuff is going to come
big time,
and so it feels to me like you could watch it again in another 20 years and go, fucking hell, we didn't even know what was around the corner with,
yeah,
with,
now we've got baby humanoids and,
yeah.
100% though, I'm with you.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't say this as a way to say it doesn't hold up, but I think there's something funny about these early AI films, which is natural, that they miss the element of sort of the networked intelligence. So, because there's no internet yet, but I feel like modern AI, that's a big part of it. Like the Matrix, obviously.
Just on that, sorry, mate. There's a, in the news, I just read a little Easter eggy sort of summary type thing. And yeah, I think the newspaper that Deckard's holding when he's hanging out under the awning at the beginning, one of the headline stories is World Computers Connect or something along those lines.
Right. Oh, there you go.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, cool. It's there's a good YouTube clip if you pretty much just Googled Blade Runner, and one of the sort of fifth or so videos along is about 40 minutes of the guy giving Easter egg type things from how it connects to other films, homages in other films and little Easter eggy bits and pieces. It's worth a watch.
Yeah.
But that was one he threw in there.
I mean, technically it's not AI as we know it right now, what's explored in Blade Runner, because of that whole pesky thing about they're not actually quite androids. So is it technically artificial intelligence as we know it? But when you think of like Elon Musk talking, like creating a thing that's going to interface with the human brain and stuff like that.
Exactly.
There's maybe a kind of future. It's exploring something that actually could be on the cards with the kind of crazy organic cloned enhanced intelligence or something.
Yeah, and whether or not the technology is exactly the same, it's the ethical question will be the same for sure. Like, at what point does it become not cool?
Do they
to
get
kill
voting
them?
Rights?
Yeah.
Well, because the replicants are like they say the law is that they're like, I mean, law with a L-O-R-E law. Yeah. It's like they're sort of slave labor on the off-world colony, and they're that Pris is essentially a prostitute kind of replicant.
Mm. Yeah.
So there's definitely established really quickly on that they're used for manual labor and sex work, and so they're there for humans to exploit and use.
100%.
And that's why you feel sorry for them, and you're kind of rooting for them as much as you're rooting for Blade for Harrison Ford. You're kind
big
of
time. Even
you want everyone to
he's
win.
He's a prick. He's shooting.
He's kind
girls,
of a dick.
Like,
yeah, it was hard to like the first one he kills.
It's quite brutal.
Yeah.
He shoots them both.
I don't remember
back.
It being that brutal. Like, he's not that I know he's doing his job, so I guess he's sympathetic in that sense. He believes in what he's doing, I guess. But, like, I guess we're meant to feel that that's fucked up, because it feels fucked up. Anyway, we've talked about this movie long enough. Greg has to get to work, don't you, Greg? We didn't even mention, by the way, this is a global podcast today.
Yeah.
Sunglass Kid in the UK, Greg in Australia, and Tristan in the US of A.
Look at us.
So
defying time zones.
Edward's about to go to bed. Greg's about to go to work. And I'm about to eat dinner.
Go to sleep.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, we should wrap up. But before we do, Sunglass Kid, Edward, anything you want to point our listeners to? Some great music on the Spotify's and Apple Musics of the world. Anything else?
You can find me on Sunglasses Kid Music on both Instagram and TikTok, where I'm most active at the moment. You can look me up, Sunglasses Kid, on Spotify and find 3 albums.
Oh, yeah.
I just put out a couple of remixes really recently with a couple of other artists. I'm working on a new single, and I'm doing a lot of stuff at the moment behind the scenes with other artists. So I am not as active as I have been in my output, but it's not because I'm lying around doing nothing. It's because I'm busier than I've ever been with more exciting projects that I shall reveal all in the future.
Well, hopefully not the distant dystopian future.
Yeah.
day.
Pre the singularity, yeah. We we'll link to some of that stuff in the show notes as well. Yeah. So if you listen to this right now, get on your phone, click the things and go listen because it's soothing. The perfect kind of wind down after listening to a terrific AI podcast is listening to some great synth.
I'm going to listen to some now and get some work done.
Yeah, yeah. All right, friends of the show.
Cheers,
see you next
week. For joining us,
yeah, thank you for joining us.
See the rest of you next
Cheers.
Week.
Take care.
Bye. Bye.
When Harrison's on his piano, looking at all the photographs and wondering who these people are and what they're after. He's drinking, he's a bit drunk there. And as he drinks, you go off into the unicorn. So it's a reverie. And that was the only reference right there to this abstract image, which is a unicorn. Because at the end of it, he comes out of his thought process. And that never occurs again till the end of the movie. Because when he comes in that apartment, he thinks that he's gone in and killed her because they know where she is. And when they come out, there it is. Looks at the unicorn.
And it means?
He's a replicant.